Blind Sight, Disc 6.
Spindle was right. The ghosts followed us back. We began to hear voices other than Saraste's whispering up the spine. Sometimes even the brightly lit wraparound world of the drum would warp and jiggle from the corner of my eye, and more than once I saw bony, headless phantoms with too many arms nested in the scaffolding. They seemed solid enough from the corner of my eye, but any spot I focused on faded to shadow, to a dark, translucent stain against the background. They were so very fragile, these ghosts. The mere act of observation drilled holes through them. Spindle had rattled off dementias like raindrops. I went to consensus for enlightenment and found a whole other self buried below the limbic system, below the hindbrain, below even the cerebellum. It lived in the brain stem, and it was older than the vertebrates themselves. It was self-contained. It heard and saw and felt, independent of all those other parts layered over top, like evolutionary afterthoughts. It dwelt on nothing but its own survival. It had no time for planning or abstract analysis, spared effort for only the most rudimentary sensory processing. But it was fast, and it was dedicated, and it could react to threats in a fraction of the time it took its smarter roommates to even become aware of them. And even when it couldn't, when the obstinate, unyielding neocortex refused to let it off the leash, still it tried to pass on what it saw, and Isaac Spindle experienced an ineffable sense of where to reach. In a way, he had a stripped-down version of the gang in his head. Everyone did. I looked further and found God itself in the meat of the brain, found the static that had sent Bates into rapture and Michelle into convulsions. I tracked Gray syndrome to its headwaters in the temporal lobe. I heard voices ranting in the brains of schizophrenics. I found cortical infarcts that inspired people to reject their own limbs. Imagine the magnetic fields that must have acted in their stead when Cruncher tried to dismember himself. And off in some half-forgotten pest hole of 20th-century case studies, filed under Cotard syndrome, I found Amanda Bates and others of her kind, their brains torqued into denial of the very self. "I used to have a heart," one of them said listlessly from the archives. "Now I have something that beats in its place." Another demanded to be buried because his corpse was already stinking. There was more, a whole catalog of finely tuned dysfunctions that Rorschach had not yet inflicted on us. Somnambulism, agnosias, hemineglect. Consens has served up a freak show to make any mind reel at its own fragility. A woman dying of thirst within easy reach of water, not because she couldn't see the faucet, but because she couldn't recognize it. A man for whom the left side of the universe did not exist, who could neither perceive nor conceive of the left side of his body, of a room, of a line of text. A man for whom the very concept of leftness had become literally unthinkable. Sometimes we could conceive of things and still not see them, although they stood right before us. Skyscrapers appeared out of thin air. The person talking to us changed into someone else during a momentary distraction, and we didn't notice. It wasn't magic. It was barely even misdirection. They called it inattentional blindness, and it had been well known for a century or more, a tendency for the eye to simply not notice things that evolutionary experience classed as unlikely. I found the opposite of Spindle's blind sight, a malady not in which the sighted believe they are blind, but one in which the blind insist they can see. The very idea was absurd unto insanity, and yet there they were, retinas detached, optic nerves burned away, any possibility of vision denied by the laws of physics, bumping into walls, tripping over furniture, inventing endless ludicrous explanations for their clumsiness. The lights unexpectedly turned off by some other party. A colorful bird glimpsed through the window, distracting attention from the obstacle ahead. "I can see perfectly well, thank you. Nothing wrong with my eyes." Gauges in the head, Spindle had called them. But there were other things in there, too. there was a model of the world, and we didn't look outward at all. Our conscious selves saw only the simulation in our heads, an interpretation of reality, endlessly refreshed by input from the senses. What happens when those senses go dark, but the model, thrown off kilter by some trauma or tumor, fails to refresh? How long do we stare in at that obsolete rendering, recycling and massaging the same old data in a desperate subconscious act of utterly honest denial? How long before it dawns on us that the world we see no longer reflects the world we inhabit, that we are blind? Months, sometimes, according to the case files. For one poor woman, a year and more. Appeals to logic fail utterly. How could you see the bird when there is no window? How do you decide where your seen half-world ends if you can't see the other half to weigh it against? If you are dead, how can you smell your own corruption? If you do not exist, Amanda, what is talking to us now? Useless. When you're in the grip of Cotard syndrome or hemineglect, you cannot be swayed by argument. When you're enthralled to some alien artifact, you know that the self is gone, that reality ends at the midline. You know it with the same unshakable certainty of any man regarding the location of his own limbs, with that hardwired awareness that needs no other confirmation. Against that conviction, what is reason? What is logic? Inside Rorschach, they had no place at all. On the sixth orbit, it acted. "It's talking to us," James said. Her eyes were wide behind the faceplate, but not bright, not manic. Around us, Rorschach's guts oozed and crawled at the corner of my eye. It still took effort to ignore the illusion. Foreign words scrabbled like small animals below my brain stem as I tried to focus on a ring of finger-sized protrusions that picketed a patch of wall. "It's not talking," Spindle said from across the artery. "You're hallucinating again." Bates said nothing. Two grunts hovered in the middle of the space, panning across three axes. "It's different this time," James insisted. "The geometry, it's not so symmetrical. Looks almost like the Phaistos disk." She spun slowly, pointed down the passage. "I think it's stronger down here." "Bring Michelle out," Spindle suggested. "Maybe she can talk some sense into you." James laughed weakly. "Never say die, do you?" She tweaked her pistol and coasted into deeper gloom. "Yes, it's definitely stronger here. There's content superimposed on—" Quick as a blink, Rorschach cut her off. I'd never seen anything move so fast before. There was none of the languor we'd grown accustomed to from Rorschach's septa, no lazy drift to contraction. The iris snapped shut in an instant. Suddenly, the artery just ended 3 meters ahead, with a matte black membrane filigreed in fine spiral. And the gang of four was on the other side. The grunts were on it immediately, lasers crackling through the air. Bates was yelling, "Get behind me, stick to the walls," kicking herself into space like an acrobat in Fast Forward, taking some tactical high ground that must have been obvious to her, at least. I edged toward the perimeter. Threads of superheated plasma sliced the air, shimmering. Spindle, at the corner of my eye, hugged the opposite side of the tunnel. The walls crawled. I could see the lasers taking a toll. The septum peeled back from their touch like burning paper, black oily smoke writhing from its crisping edges, and sudden brightness everywhere. A riot of fractured light flooded the artery, a thousand shifting angles of incidence and reflection. It was like being trapped in the belly of a kaleidoscope pointed at the sun. Light and needle-sharp pain in my side, in my left arm, the smell of charred meat. A scream cut off. "Susan, you there, Susan?" "We're taking you first." Around me, the light died. Inside me, a swarm of floaters mixed it up with the chronic half-visions Rorschach had already planted in my head. Alarms chirped irritatingly in my helmet, breach, 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 until the smart fabric of the suit softened and congealed where the holes had been. Something stung maddeningly in my left side. I felt as if I'd been branded. "Keaton, check spindle," Bates had called off the lasers. The grunts closed for hand to hand, reaching with fiery nozzles and diamond-tipped claws to grapple with some prismatic material glowing softly behind that burnt-back skin. Fibrous reflector, I realized. It had shattered the laser light, turned it into luminous shrapnel, and thrown it back in our faces. Clever. But its surface was still alight, even with the lasers down. A diffuse glow, dipping and weaving, filtered through from the far side of the barrier, while the drones chewed doggedly through the near one. After a moment it struck me. James's headlamp. "Keaton!" Right. Spindle. His faceplate was intact. The laser had melted the Faraday mesh laminated onto the crystal, but the suit was sealing that tiny hole even now. The hole behind, drilled neatly through his forehead, remained. The eyes beneath stared at infinity. "Well?" Bates asked. She could read his vitals as easily as I, but Theseus was capable of post-mortem rebuilds. Barring brain damage? No. The whine of drills and shredders stopped. The ambience brightened. I looked away from Spindle's remains. The grunts had cut a hole in the septum's fibrous underlayer. One of them nosed its way through to the other side. A new sound rose into the mix, a soft animal keening, haunted and dissonant. For a moment I thought Rorschach was whispering to us again. Its walls seemed to contract slightly around me. "James?" Bates snapped. "James!" Not James. A little girl in a woman's body in an armored spacesuit, scared out of her wits. The grunt nudged her curled up body back into our company. Bates took it gently. "Susan, come back, Suze. You're safe." The grunts hovered restlessly, alert in every direction, pretending everything was under control. Bates spared me a glance, "Take Isaac," and turned back to James. "Susan?"
No,
whimpered a small voice, a little girl's voice. "Michelle, is that you?"
"There was a thing," the little girl said. "It grabbed me. It grabbed my leg."
"We're out of here." Bates pulled the gang back along the passage. One grunt lingered, watching the hole. The other took point. "It's gone," Bates said gently. "There's nothing there now. See the feed?"
"You can't see it,"
Michelle whispered.
It's invisible.
The septum receded around a curve as we retreated. The hole torn through its center watched us like the ragged pupil of some great unblinking eye. It stayed empty as long as it stayed in sight. Nothing came out after us. Nothing we could see. A thought began cycling through my head. Some half-assed eulogy stolen from an eavesdropped confessional. And try as I might, I couldn't shut it down. Isaac Spindle hadn't made the semifinals after all. Susan James came back to us on the way up. Isaac Spindle did not. We stripped wordlessly in the decon balloon. Bates, first out of her suit, reached for Spindle, but the gang stopped her with a hand and a headshake. Personae segued one into another as they stripped the body. Susan removed helmet and backpack and breastplate. Cruncher peeled away the silvery leaded skin from collar to toe. Sasha stripped the jumpsuit and left the pale flesh naked and exposed. Except for the gloves. They left his feedback gloves in place. Their fingertips forever tactile, the flesh inside forever numb. Through it all, Spindle stared unblinking beneath the hole in his forehead, his glazed eyes focused on distant quasars. I expected Michelle to appear in her turn and close them, but she never did.
You have eyes, but you do not see. Jesus the Nazarene. I don't know how to feel about this, I thought. He was a good man. He was decent. He was kind to me, even when he didn't know I was listening in. I didn't know him long. He wasn't a friend, exactly. But still, I should miss him. I should mourn. I should feel more than the sick, sinking fear that I could be next. Sarasti hadn't wasted any time. Spindle's replacement met us as we emerged, freshly thawed, nicotine-scented. The rehydration of his flesh was ongoing. Saline bladders clung to each thigh, although it would never entirely erase the sharpness of his features. His bones cracked when he moved. He looked past me and took the body. Susan? Michelle? I... The gang turned away. He coughed, began fumbling a body condom over the corpse. Sarasti wants everyone in the drum. We're hot, Bates said. Even cut short, the excursion had piled up the lethal sievert count. Faint nausea tickled the back of my throat. Decontaminate later. One long pull of a zipper, and Spindle was gone, engulfed in an oily gray shroud. You, he turned in my direction, pointed at the scorched holes in my jumpsuit. With me. Robert Cunningham. Another prototype. Dark-haired, hollow-cheeked, a jaw you could use as a ruler. Both smoother and harsher than the man he had replaced. Where Spindle had ticked and jerked as if static-charged, Cunningham's face held all the expression of a wax dummy's. The wetware that ran those muscles had been press-ganged into other pursuits. Even the tremors that afflicted the rest of his body were muted, soothed by the nicotine he drew with every second breath. He held no cigarette now. He held only the shrouded body of his hard-luck primary, and his ongoing, freshly thawed distaste for the ship's synthesist. His fingers trembled. Bates and the gang moved silently up the spine. Cunningham and I followed, guiding the shroud of Spindle between us. My leg and side were stinging again, now that Cunningham had reminded them to. There wouldn't be much he could do about them, though. The beams would have cauterized the flesh on their way through, and if they'd hit anything vital, I'd have been dead already. At the hatch, we broke into single file, Spindle first, Cunningham pushing at his heels. By the time I emerged into the drum, Bates and the gang were already down on deck and taking their usual seats. Sarasti, in the flesh, watched them from the end of the conference table. His eyes were naked. From this angle, the soft, full-spectrum light of the drum washed the shine from them. If you didn't look too closely, for too long, you might almost think those eyes were human. Biomed had been spun down for my arrival. Cunningham pointed to a diagnostic couch on a section of the still deck that served as our infirmary. I floated over and strapped myself in. 2 meters away, past a waist-high guardrail that had risen from the deck, the rest of the drum rolled smoothly past. It slung Bates and the gang and Sarasti around like weights on a string. I tapped consensus to hear them. James was speaking, quietly and without expression. I noticed a new pattern in the form constants, something in the grating. It looked like a signal. It got stronger as I went down the tunnel. I followed it. I blacked out. I don't remember anything more until we were on our way back. Michelle filled me in as much as she could. That's all I know. I'm sorry. 100 degrees away in the no-G zone, Cunningham maneuvered his predecessor into a coffin with different options than those up front. I wondered if it would embark on an autopsy during the debriefing. I wondered if we'd be able to hear the sounds it made. Sasha, Sarasti said. Yeah. Sasha's trademark drawl infected the voice. I was riding Mom. Went deaf and dumb and stark fucking blind when she passed out. I tried to take over, but something was blocking me, Michelle, I guess. Never thought she had it in her. I couldn't even see.
But you don't lose consciousness.
I was awake the whole time, far as I know, just completely in the dark.
Smell? Tactile?
I could feel it when Michelle pissed in the suit, but I didn't notice anything else.
Cunningham was back at my side. The inevitable cigarette had appeared between his lips.
Nothing touches you, the vampire surmised. Nothing grabs your leg.
No, Sasha said. She didn't believe Michelle's stories about invisible monsters. None of us did. Why bother when dementia could so easily explain anything we experienced?
Cruncher.
Don't know anything.
I still wasn't used to the maleness of the voice now emanating from James's throat. Cruncher was a workaholic. He hardly ever surfaced in mixed company.
You're there, Sarasti reminded him. You must remember some.
Mom sent me some patterns to parse. I was working on them. I'm still working on them, he added pointedly. I didn't notice anything.
Is that all?
I'd never been able to get a good read on him. Sometimes Cruncher seemed to have more in common with the dozens of non-conscious modules working in James's head than with the sentient hubs comprising the rest of the gang.
You feel nothing, Sarasti pressed.
Just the patterns.
Anything significant?
Standard phenomath spirals and gratings, but I haven't finished. Can I go now?
Yes. Call Michelle, please.
Cunningham stabbed at my wounds with anabolizers, muttering to himself. Faint blue smoke curled between us.
Isaac found some tumors, he observed.
I nodded and coughed. My throat was sore. The nausea had grown heavy enough to sink below my diaphragm.
Michelle, Sarasti repeated.
I see some more here, Cunningham continued, along the bottom of your brain pan. Only a few dozen cells so far, they're not worth burning yet.
Here.
Michelle's voice was barely audible, even through consensus, but at least it was the voice of an adult.
I'm here.
What do you remember, please?
I was just riding Mom, and then she was gone, and there was no one else, so I had to take over.
Do you see the septum close?
Not really. I felt it going dark, but when I turned around, we were already trapped. And then I felt something behind me. It wasn't loud or harsh, it just sort of bumped, and it grabbed me, and I'm sorry, she said after a moment. I'm a bit woozy.
Sarasti waited.
Isaac? Michelle whispered.
Yes.
A pause.
We're very sorry about that.
Maybe he can be fixed?
No. There's brain damage.
There was something like sympathy in the vampire's voice, the practiced affectation of an accomplished mimic. There was something else, too, an all but imperceptible hunger, a subtle edge of temptation. I don't think anyone heard it but me. We were sick and getting sicker. Predators are drawn to the weak and injured. Michelle had fallen silent again. When she continued, her voice only faltered a little.
I can't tell you much. It grabbed me. It let me go. I went to pieces, and I can't explain why, except that fucking place just does things to you, and I was weak. I'm sorry. There's not much else to tell you.
Thank you,
Sarasti said after a long moment.
I'd like to leave, if that's okay.
Yes,
Sarasti said. Michelle sank below the surface as the commons rotated past. I didn't see who took her place.
The grunts didn't see anything, Bates remarked. By the time we broke through the septum, the tunnel behind was empty.
Any bogey would have had plenty of time to hightail, Cunningham said.
He planted his feet on the deck and grabbed a handhold. The subdrum began to move. I drifted obliquely against my restraints.
I don't disagree, Bates said, but if there's anything we've learned about that place, it's that we can't trust our senses.
Trust Michelle's, Saresti said.
He opened a window as I grew heavier, a grunt's eye view of a fuzzy, bright blob weaving behind the translucent waxed paper fibers of the skin septum. James's headlight from the wrong side of the barrier. The image wobbled a bit as the drone staggered through some local pocket of magnetism, then replayed, wobbled, replayed, a 6-second loop.
See something next to the gang.
Non-vampires saw no such thing. Saresti froze the image, evidently realizing as much.
Diffraction patterns aren't consistent with a single light source in open space. I see dimmer elements, reflective elements, two dark objects close together, similar size, scattering light here.
A cursor appeared at two utterly nondescript points on the image, and here.
One's the gang, the other's unaccounted for.
Just a minute, Cunningham said. If you can see it through all that, why didn't Michelle see anything?
Synesthesiac, Saresti reminded him. You see, she feels.
Biomed jerked slightly, locking into spin sync with the drum. The guardrail sank back into the deck. In some far-off corner, something without eyes watched me watching it.
Shit, Bates whispered. There's someone home.
They never really talked like that, by the way. You'd hear gibberish, a half dozen languages, a whole babble of personal idioms, if I spoke in their real voices. Some of the simpler tics make it through. Sasha's good-natured belligerence, Saresti's aversion to the past tense. Cunningham lost most of his gender pronouns to an unforeseen glitch during the work on his temporal lobe. But it went beyond that. The whole lot of them threw English and Hindi and Hodzani into every second sentence. No real scientist would allow their thoughts to be hamstrung by the conceptual limitations of a single language. Other times they acted almost as synthesists in their own right, conversing in grunts and gestures that would be meaningless to any baseline. It's not so much that the bleeding edge lacks social skills. It's just that once you get past a certain point, formal speech is too damn slow. Except for Susan James, the walking contradiction, the woman so devoted to communication as unifier that she'd cut her own brain into disunified chunks to make the point. She was the only one who ever seemed to care who she was talking to. The others spoke only for themselves, even when they spoke to each other. Even James's other corps would speak their own minds in their own way and let everyone else translate as best they could. It wasn't a problem. Everyone on Theseus could read everyone else. But that didn't matter to Susan James. She fit each of her words to their intended recipient. She accommodated. I am a conduit. I exist to bridge the gap, and I'd bridge nothing if I only told you what these people said. So I am telling you what they meant, and it will mean as much to you as you can handle. Except for Susan James, linguist and ringleader, whom I trust to speak for herself. 15 minutes to apogee, maximum safe distance in case Rorschach decided to hit back. Far below, the artifact's magnetic field pressed into Ben's atmosphere like God's little finger. Great dark thunderheads converged behind it. Turbulent moon-sized curlicues collided in its wake. 15 minutes to apogee, and Bates was still hoping Saresti would change his mind. In a way, this was her fault. If she had just treated this new travail as one more cross to bear, perhaps things would have gone on more or less as before. There would have been some faint hope that Saresti would have let us grit our teeth and keep on going, besieged now by spring-loaded trapdoors, as well as the usual gauntlet of sieverts and magnets and monsters from the id. But Bates had made an issue out of it. It wasn't just another piece of shit in the sewer to her. It was the one that clogged the pipe. We're on the brink as it is, just surviving the baseline environment of this thing. If it started taking deliberate countermeasures, I don't see how we can risk it. 14 minutes to apogee, and Amanda Bates was still regretting those words. On previous expeditions, we'd charted 26 septa in various stages of development. We'd x-rayed them. We'd done ultrasound. We'd watched them ooze their way across passages or ebb slowly back into the walls. The iris that had snapped shut behind the gang of four had been a whole different animal. And what are the odds that the first one with a hair trigger just happened to also come with anti-laser prismatics? That was no routine growth event. That thing was set for us. Set by... That was the other thing. 13 minutes to apogee, and Bates was worried about the tenants. It had always been breaking and entering, of course. That much hadn't changed. But when we jimmied the lock, we'd thought we were vandalizing an empty summer cottage still under construction. We'd thought the owners would be out of the picture for a while. We hadn't been expecting one of them to catch us on his way to take a late-night piss. And now that one had and vanished into the labyrinth, it was natural to wonder what weapons it might keep stashed under the pillow. Those septa could spring on us at any time. How many are there? Are they fixed or portable? We can't proceed without knowing these things. At first, Bates had been surprised and delighted when Sarasti agreed with her. 12 minutes to apogee. From this high ground, well above the static, Theseus peered down through Rorschach's wrenched and twisted anatomy to keep rock-steady eyes on the tiny wound we'd burned in its side. Our limpet tent covered it like a blister. Inside, Jack fed us a second first-person view of the unfolding experiment. Sir, we know Rorschach is inhabited. Do we want to risk further provoking the inhabitants? Do we want to risk killing them? Sarasti hadn't quite looked at her and hadn't quite spoken. If he had, he might have said, I do not understand how meat like you survive to adulthood. 11 minutes to apogee, and Amanda Bates was lamenting the fact, not for the first time, that this mission was not under military jurisdiction. We were waiting for maximum distance before performing the experiment. Rorschach might interpret this as a hostile act, Sarasti had conceded in a voice that contained no trace of irony whatsoever. Now he stood before us, watching consensus play on the table. Reflections writhed across his naked eyes, not quite masking the deeper reflections behind them. 10 minutes to apogee. Susan James was wishing that Cunningham would put out that goddamn cigarette. The smoke stank on its way to the ventilators, and anyway it wasn't necessary. It was just an anachronistic affectation, an attention-getting device. If he needed the nicotine, a patch could have soothed his tremors just as easily, without the smoke and the stink. That wasn't all she was thinking, though. She was wondering why Cunningham had been summoned to Sarasti's quarters earlier in the shift, why he'd looked at her so strangely afterward. I wondered about that myself. A quick check on Consensus timestamps showed that her medical file had been accessed during that period. I checked those stats, let the shapes bounce between hemispheres. Part of my brain locked on elevated oxytocin as the probable reason for that conference. There was an 82% chance that James had become too trusting for Sarasti's liking. I had no idea how I knew that. I never did. 9 minutes to apogee. Barely a molecule of Rorschach's atmosphere had been lost on our account. That was all about to change. Our view of base camp split like a dividing bacterium. One window now focused on the limpet tent, the other on a wide-angle tactical enhance of the space around it. 8 minutes to apogee. Sarasti pulled the plug. Down on Rorschach, our tent burst like a bug beneath a boot. A geyser erupted from the wound. A snowstorm swirled at its edges, its charged curlicues intricate as lace. Atmosphere gushed into vacuum, spread thin, crystallized. Briefly, the space around base camp sparkled. It was almost beautiful. Bates didn't think it was beautiful at all. She watched that bleeding wound with a face as expressionless as Cunningham's, but her jaw was clenched onto tetanus. Her eyes darted between views, watching for things gasping in the shadows. Rorschach convulsed. Vast trunks and arteries shuddered, a seismic tremor radiated out along the structure. The epicenter began to twist, a vast segment rotating on its axis, the breach midway along its length. Stress lines appeared where the length that rotated sheared against the lengths to either side that didn't. The structure seemed to soften and stretch there, constricting like a great elongate balloon torquing itself into sausage links. Sarasti clicked. Cats made something of that sound when they spied a bird on the far side of a window pane. Consensus groaned with the sound of worlds scraping against each other. Telemetry from the on-site sensors, their ears to the ground. Jack's camera controls had frozen again. The image it sent was canted and grainy. The pickup stared blankly at the edge of the hole we'd bored into the underworld. The groaning subsided. A final faint cloud of crystalline stardust dissipated into space, barely visible even on Max and Hance. No bodies. None visible, anyway. Sudden motion at base camp. At first I thought it was static on Jack's feed, playing along lines of high contrast, but no, something was definitely moving along the edges of the hole we'd burned. Something almost wriggled there, a thousand gray mycelia extruding from the cut surface and writhing slowly into the darkness. It's... Huh, Bates said. Triggered by the pressure drop, I guess. That's one way to seal a breach. 2 weeks after we'd wounded it, Rorschach had begun to heal itself. Apogee behind us now. All downhill from here. Theseus began the long drop back into enemy territory. Doesn't use septa, Sarasti said. My genes done gone and tricked my brain by making fucking feel so great. That's how the little creeps attain their plan to fucking replicate. But brain's got tricks itself, you see, to get the bang but not the bite. I got this here vasectomy. My genes can fuck themselves tonight. The R selectors. Trunclade. First person sex, real sex, as Chelsea insisted on calling it, was an acquired taste. Jagged breathing, the raw slap and stink of sweaty skin full of pores and blemishes, a whole other person with a whole other set of demands and dislikes. There was definite animal appeal, no doubt about it. This was, after all, how we'd done it for millions of years. But this third-world carnality, had always carried an element of struggle, of asynchronous patterns and conflict. There was no convergence here. There was only the rhythm of bodies in collision, a struggle for dominance, each trying to force the other into sync. Chelsea regarded it as love in its purest form. I came to think of it as hand-to-hand combat. Before, whether fucking creations from my own menu or slip-on skins from someone else's, I had always selected the contrast and the res, the texture and the attitude. The bodily functions, the resistance of competing desires, the endless foreplay that wears your tongue to the root and leaves your face sticky and glistening. Just kinks today, options for the masochistic. But there were no options with Chelsea. With her, everything came standard. I indulged her. I guess I was no more patient with her perversions than she was with my ineptitude at them. Other things made it worth the effort. Chelsea would argue about anything under the sun, wry and insightful and curious as a cat. She would pounce without warning. Retired to the redundant majority, she still took such simple joy in the very act of being alive. She was impulsive and impetuous. She cared about people. Pag, me. She wanted to know me. She wanted in. That was proving to be a problem.
We could try it again, she said once in an aftermath of sweat and pheromones. And you won't even remember what you were so upset about. You won't even remember you were upset if you don't want to.
I smiled and looked away. Suddenly the planes of her face were coarse and unappealing. How many times is that now? 8? 9?
I just want you to be happy, Sig. True happiness is one hell of a gift, and I can give it to you if you'll let me.
You don't want me happy, I said pleasantly. You want me customized. She mmmed into the hollow of my throat for a moment. Then,
what?
You just want to change me into something more accommodating. Chelsea lifted her head.
Look at me.
I turned my head. She'd shut down the chromatophores in her cheek. The tattoo, transplanted, fluttered now on her shoulder.
Look at my eyes, Chelsea said.
I looked at the imperfect skin around them, at the capillaries wriggling across the whites. I felt a distant bemusement that such flawed, decaying organs were still able to hypnotize me on occasion.
Now, Chelsea said, what do you mean by that?
I shrugged.
You keep pretending this is a partnership. We both know it's a competition. A competition. You're trying to manipulate me into playing by your rules. What rules? The way you want the relationship run. I don't blame you, Chels, not in the least. We've been trying to manipulate each other for as long as, hell, it's not even human nature. It's mammalian.
I don't believe it. She shook her head. Ropey tendrils of hair swung across her face.
It's the middle of the 21st century, and you're hitting me with this war of the sexes bullshit?
Granted, your tweaks are a pretty radical iteration. Get right in there and reprogram your mate for optimum servility.
You actually think I'm trying to housebreak you? You think I'm trying to train you like a puppy?
You're just doing what comes naturally.
I can't believe you'd pull this shit on me.
I thought you valued honesty in relationships.
What relationship? According to you, there's no such thing. This is just mutual rape or something.
That's what relationships are.
Don't pull that shit on me.
She sat up, swung her feet over the edge of the bed, putting her back to me.
I know how I feel. If I know anything, I know that much. And I only wanted to make you happy.
I know you believe that, I said gently. I know it doesn't feel like a strategy. Nothing does when it's wired that deeply. It just feels right. It feels natural. It's nature's trick. It's someone's fucking trick. I sat up next to her, let my shoulder brush hers. She leaned away. I know this stuff, I said after a while. I know how people work. It's my job. It was hers too, for that matter. Nobody who spliced brains for a living could possibly be unaware of all that basic wiring in the sub-basement. Chelsea had simply chosen to ignore it. To have admitted anything would have compromised her righteous anger. I could have pointed that out too, I suppose, but I knew how much stress the system could take, and I wasn't ready to test it to destruction. I didn't want to lose her. I didn't want to lose that feeling of safety. That sense that it made a difference whether I lived or died. I only wanted her to back off a bit. I only wanted room to breathe.
You can be such a reptile sometimes, she said.
Mission accomplished. Our first approach had been all caution and safety margins. This time we came in like a strike force. Scylla burned toward Rorschach at over 2G, its trajectory a smooth and predictable arc ending at the ruptured base camp. It may have even landed there, for all I know. Perhaps Sarasti had two-birded the mission, programmed the shuttle for some collecting of its own. If so, it wouldn't land with us on board. Scylla spat us into space almost 50 kilometers short of the new beachhead. Left us naked and plummeting on some wireframe contraption with barely enough reaction mass for a soft landing and a quick getaway. We didn't even have control over that. Success depended on unpredictability, and how better to ensure that to not even know ourselves what we were doing. Sarasti's logic. Vampire logic. We could follow it part way. The colossal deformation that had sealed Rorschach's breach was so much slower, so much more expensive than the dropgate that had trapped the gang. The fact that dropgates hadn't been used implied that they took time to deploy, to redistribute necessary mass, perhaps, or spring-load its reflexes. That gave us a window. We could still venture into the den so long as the lions couldn't predict our destination and set traps in advance, so long as we got out again before they could set them afterward. 37 minutes, Sarasti had said, and none of us could fathom how he'd come to that number. Only Bates had dared to ask aloud, and he had merely glinted at her. You can't follow. Vampire logic. From an obvious premise to an opaque conclusion. Our lives depended on it. The retros followed some pre-programmed algorithm that mated Newton with a roll of the dice. Our vector wasn't completely random. Once we'd eliminated raceways and growth zones, areas without line-of-sight escape routes, dead ends and unbranched segments. Boring, Sarasti said, dismissing them. Barely 10% of the artifact remained in the running. Now we dropped toward a warren of brambles 8 kilometers from our original landing site. Here in the midst of our final approach, there was no way that even we could predict our precise point of impact. If Rorschach could, it deserved to win. We fell. Ridged spires and gnarled limbs sectioned the sky wherever I looked, cut the distant starscape and the imminent Superjovian into a jagged mosaic, veined and black. 3 kilometers away, or 30, the tip of some swollen extremity burst in a silent explosion of charged particles, a distant fog of ruptured, freezing atmosphere. Even as it faded, I could make out wisps and streamers swirling into complex spirals, Rorschach's magnetic field sculpting the artifact's very breath into radioactive sleet. I'd never seen it with naked eyes before. I felt like an insect on a starry midwinter's night, falling through the aftermath of a forest fire. The sled fired its brakes. I snapped back against the webbing of my harness, bumped against the rebounding armored body next to me. Sasha. Only Sasha, I remembered. Cunningham had sedated the rest of them, left this one core lonely and alone in the group body. I hadn't even realized that that was possible with multiple personalities. She stared back at me from behind her faceplate. None of her surfaces showed through the suit. I could see nothing in her eyes. That was happening so often these days. Cunningham was not with us. Nobody had asked why when Sarasti assigned the berths. The biologist was first among equals now, a backup restored with no other behind him, the second least replaceable of our irreplaceable crew. It made me a better bargain. The odds I bought had increased to 1 in 3. A silent bump shuddered up the frame. I looked forward again, past Bates on the front pallet, past the anchored drones that flanked her 2 on each side. The sled had launched its assault, a prefab inflatable vestibule mounted on an explosive injection assembly that would punch through Rorschach's skin like a virus penetrating a host cell. The spindle-legged contraption dwindled and disappeared from my sight. Moments later, a pinpoint sodium sun flared and died against the ebony landscape ahead. Antimatter charge, so small you could almost count the atoms, shot directly into the hull. A lot rougher than the tentative foreplay of our first date. We landed hard while the vestibule was still inflating. The grunts were off the sled an instant before contact, spitting tiny puffs of gas from their nozzles, arranging themselves around us in a protective rosette. Bates was up next, leaping free of her restraints and sailing directly toward the swelling hab. Sasha and I unloaded the fiber op hub, a clamshell drum 1/2 meter thick and 3 times as wide, lugging it between us while one of the grunts slipped through the vestibule's membranous airlock. Let's move, people. Bates was hanging off one of the inflatable handholds. 30 minutes to... She fell silent. I didn't have to ask why. The advance grunt had positioned itself over the newly blasted entrance and sent back its first postcard. Light from below. You'd think that would have made it easier. Our kind has always feared the dark. For millions of years, we huddled in caves and burrows while unseen things snuffled and growled, or just waited, silent and undetectable, in the night beyond. You'd think that any light, no matter how meager, might strip away some of the shadows, leave fewer holes for the mind to fill with worst imaginings. You'd think. We followed the grunt down into a dim, soupy glow like blood-curdled milk. At first it seemed as though the atmosphere itself was a light, a luminous fog that obscured anything more than 10 meters distant. An illusion, as it turned out. The tunnel we emerged into was about 3 meters wide and lit by rows of raised glowing dashes, the size and approximate shape of dismembered human fingers, wound in a loose triple helix around the walls. We'd recorded similar ridges at the first sight, although the breaks had not been so pronounced and the ridges had been anything but luminous. "Stronger in the near infrared," Bates reported, flashing the spectrum to our HUDs. The air would have been transparent to pit vipers. It was transparent to sonar. The lead grunt sprayed the fog with click trains and discovered the tunnel widened into some kind of chamber 17 meters farther along. Squinting in that direction, I could just make out subterranean outlines through the mist. I could just make out jawed things, pulling back out of sight. "Let's go," Bates said. We plugged in the grunts, left one guarding the way out. Each of us took another as guardian angel on point. The machines spoke to our HUDs via laser link. They spoke to each other along stiffened lengths of shielded fiber top that unspooled from the hub trailing in our wake. It was the best available compromise in an environment without any optima. Our tethered bodyguards would keep us all in touch during lone excursions around corners or down dead ends. Yeah, lone excursions. Forced to either split the group or cover less ground, we were to split the group. We were speed cartographers panning for gold. Everything we did here was an act of faith. Faith that the unifying principles of Rorschach's internal architecture could be derived from the raw dimensions we'd grab on the run. Faith that Rorschach's internal architecture even had unifying principles. Earlier generations had worshipped malign and capricious spirits. Ours put its faith in an ordered universe. Here in the Devil's Baklava, it was easy to wonder if our ancestors hadn't been closer to the mark. We moved along the tunnel. Our destination resolved to merely human eyes. Not so much chamber as nexus, a knot of space formed by the convergence of a dozen tunnels angling in from different orientations. Ragged meshes of quicksilver dots gleamed along several glistening surfaces. Shiny protrusions poked through the substrate like a scattershot blast of ball bearings pressed into wet clay. I looked at Bates and Sasha. "Control panel?" Bates shrugged. Her drones panned the throats around us, spraying sonar down each. My HUD sketched a patchy 3D model from the echoes, swaths of paint thrown against invisible walls. We were dots near the center of a ganglion, a tiny swarm of parasites infesting some great hollowed host. Each tunnel curved away in a gradual spiral, each along a different orientation. Sonar could peep around those bends a few meters farther than we could. Neither eyes nor ultrasonic saw anything to distinguish one choice from another. Bates pointed down one of the passageways, Keaton, and another, Sasha, before turning to coast off down her own unbeaten path. I looked uneasily down mine. "Any particular 25 minutes, she said. I turned and jetted slowly down my assigned passageway. The passage curved clockwise, a long, unremarkable spiral. After 20 meters, that curvature would have blocked any view of its entrance, even if the foggy atmosphere hadn't. My drone kept point across the tunnel, its sonar clicking like the chattering of 1,000 tiny teeth, its tether unspooling back to the distant drum in the Nexus. It was a comfort, that leash. It was short. The grunts could stray 90 meters and no farther, and we were under strict orders to stay under their wings at all time. This dim, infested burrow might lead all the way to hell, but I would not be expected to follow it nearly so far. My cowardice had official sanction. 50 meters to go. 50 meters, and I could turn and run with my tail between my legs. In the meantime, all I had to do was grit my teeth and focus and record. "Everything you see," Saresti had said, "as much as possible of what you can't." And hope that this new reduced time limit would expire before Rorschach spiked us into gibbering dementia. The walls around me twitched and shivered like the flesh of something just killed. Something darted in and out of sight with a faint cackle of laughter. Focus, record. If the grunt doesn't see it, it's not real. 65 meters in, one of the ghosts got inside my helmet. I tried to ignore it. I tried to look away, but this phantom wasn't flickering at the edge of vision. It hovered near the center of my faceplate, floating like a spot of swirling dizziness between me and the HUD. I gritted my teeth and tried to look past, stared into the dim, bloody haze of the middle distance, watched the jerky unfolding travelogues in the little windows labeled Bates and James. Nothing out there, but in here, floating before my eyes, Rorschach's latest headfuck smeared a fuzzy thumbprint right in front of the sonar feed. "New symptom," I called in. "Non-peripheral hallucination, stable, pretty formless though. No spiking that I can..." The inset marked Bates skidded hard about. "Keet!" Window and voice cut out together. Not just Bates's window either. Sasha's inset and the drone's eye sonarscape flickered and died at that same moment, stripped my HUD bare except for in-suit feeds and a little red readout flashing, "Link down." I spun, but the grunt was still there, 3 meters off my right shoulder. Its optical port was clearly visible, a ruby thumbnail set into the plastron. Its gun ports were visible too, pointing at me. I froze. The drone shivered in some local electromagnetic knot as if terrified of me or of something behind me. I started to turn. My helmet filled with sudden static and with what sounded faintly like a voice. "Fucking move, Keet. No. Bates? Bates?" Another icon had bloomed in place of Link down. The grunt was using radio for some reason, and though almost close enough to touch, I could barely make out the signal. A hash of Bates speak. "To your... right in front of..." And Sasha as well, a bit more clearly. "Can't see it?" "See what? Sasha, someone tell me what. See what? Read? Keaton, do you read?" Somehow Bates had boosted the signal. Static roared like an ocean, but I could hear the words behind it. "Yes. What? Keep absolutely still. Do you understand? Absolutely still. Acknowledge." "Acknowledged." The drone kept me in its shaky sights. Dark stereocam irises spasming wide, stuttering to pinpoints. "What? There's something in front of you, Keaton, directly between you and the grunt. Can't you see it?" "No." My HUD's down, Sasha broke in. "How can he not see it? It's right there." Bates barked over her. "It's man-sized, radially symmetrical, 8-9 arms, like tentacles, but segmented, spiky." "I don't see anything," I said. But I did. I saw something reaching for me in my pod back aboard Theseus. I saw something curled up motionless in the ship's spine, watching as we laid our best plans. I saw Michelle, the synesthesiac, curled into a fetal ball. "You can't see it, it's invisible." "What's it doing?" I called. "Why can't I see it? Why can't I see it?" "Just floating there, kind of waving." "Oh shit, Keep. The grunt skidded sideways as it slapped by a giant hand. It bounced off the wall, and suddenly the laser link was back, filling the HUD with intelligence. First-person perspectives of Bates and Sasha racing along alien tunnels, a grunt's-eye view of a spacesuit with Keaton stenciled across its breastplate, and there, right beside it, some thing like a rippling starfish with too many arms. The gang barreled around the curve, and now I almost could see something with my own eyes, flickering like heat lightning off to one side. It was large, and it was moving, but somehow my eyes just slid off every time they tried to get a fix. It's not real, I thought, giddy with hysterical relief. It's just another hallucination. But then Bates sailed into view, and it was right there. No flickering, no uncertainty, nothing but a collapsed probability wave and solid, undeniable mass. Exposed, it grabbed the nearest wall and scrambled over our heads, segmented arms flailing like whips. A sudden crackling buzz in the back of my head, and it was drifting free again, charred and smoking. A stuttering click, the whine of machinery gearing down. Three grunts hovered in formation in the middle of the passageway. One faced the alien. I glimpsed the tip of some lethal proboscis sliding back into its sheath. Bates shut the grunt down before it had finished closing its mouth. Optical links and three sets of lungs filled my helmet with a roar of heavy breathing. The offlined grunt drifted in the murky air. The alien carcass bumped gently off the wall, twitching, a hydra of human backbones, scorched and fleshless. It didn't look like my onboard visions at all. For some reason I couldn't put my finger on, I found that almost reassuring. The two active grunts panned the fog until Bates gave them new orders. Then one turned to secure the carcass, the other to steady its fallen comrade. Bates grabbed the dead grunt and unplugged its tether. Fall back, slowly. I'm right behind you. I tweaked my jets. Sasha hesitated. Coils of shielded cable floated about us like umbilical cords. Now, Bates said, plugging a feed from her own suit directly into the offlined grunt. Sasha started after me. Bates took up the rear. I watched my HUD. A swarm of multi-armed monsters would appear there any moment. They didn't. But the blackened thing against the belly of Bates's machine was real enough, not a hallucination, not even some understandable artifact of fear and synesthesia. Rorschach was inhabited. Its inhabitants were invisible. Sometimes, sort of. And oh yeah, we'd just killed one. Bates threw the deactivated grunt into the sky as soon as we'd made vacuum. Its comrades used it for target practice while we strapped in, firing and firing until there was nothing left but cooling vapor. Rorschach spun even that faint plasma into filigree before it faded. Halfway back to Theseus, Sasha turned to the Major. You know, but they do shit on their own, right? Autonomous? Not when they're slaved. Malfunction? Spike? Bates didn't answer. She called ahead. By the time we made it back, Cunningham had grown another little tumor on Theseus's spine, a remote surgery packed with teleops and sensors. One of the surviving grunts grabbed the carcass and jumped ship as soon as we passed beneath the carapace, completing the delivery as we docked. We were born again to the fruits of a preliminary necropsy. The holographic ghost of the dissected alien rose from consensus like some flayed and horrific feast. Its splayed arms looked like human spinal columns. We sat around the table and waited for someone else to take the first bite. Did you have to shoot it with microwaves? Cunningham sniped, tapping the table. You completely cooked the animal. Every cell was blown out from the inside. Bates shook her head. There was a malfunction. He gave her a sour look. A malfunction that just happens to involve precise targeting of a moving object. Doesn't sound random to me. Bates looked back evenly. Something flipped autonomous targeting from off to on. A coin toss. Random. Random is... Give it a rest, Cunningham. I don't need this shit from you right now. His eyes rolled in that smooth, dead face, focused suddenly on something overhead. I followed his gaze. Sarasti stared down at us like an owl panning for meadow voles, drifting slowly in the Coriolis breeze. No visor this time, either.
I knew he hadn't lost it. He fixed Cunningham. Your findings.
Cunningham swallowed. Bits and pieces of alien anatomy flickered with color-coded highlights as he tapped his fingers.
Right, then. I'm afraid I can't give you much at the cellular level. There's not much left inside the membranes. Not many membranes left, for that matter. In terms of gross morphology, the specimen's dorsoventrally compressed and radially symmetrical, as you can see. Calcareous exoskeleton, keratinized plastic cuticle. Nothing special.
Bates looked skeptical.
Plastic skin is nothing special. Given the environment, I was half expecting a Sandilavishu plasma. Plastic simply refined petroleum, organocarbon. This thing is carbon-based. It's even protein-based, although its proteins are a great deal tougher than ours. Numerous sulfur cross bonds for lateral bracing, as far as I could tell from what your grunts didn't denature.
Cunningham's eyes looked past us all. His consciousness was obviously far aft, haunting remote sensors.
The thing's tissues are saturated with magnetite. On Earth, you find that material in dolphin brains, migratory birds, even some bacteria, anything that navigates or orients using magnetic fields. Moving up to macrostructures, we've got a pneumatic internal skeleton, which, as far as I can tell, doubles as musculature. Contractile tissue squeezes gas through a system of bladders that stiffen or relax each segment in the arms.
The light came back into Cunningham's eyes long enough to focus on his cigarette. He brought it to his mouth, dragged deeply, set it down again.
Note the invaginations around the base of each arm.
Flaccid balloons glowed orange on the virtual carcass.
Cloacae, you could call them. Everything opens into them. They eat, breathe, and defecate through the same little compartment. No other major orifices.
The gang made a face that said Sasha grossed out.
Don't things get clogged up? Seems inefficient. If one gets plugged, there's 8 other doors into the same system. You'll wish you were so inefficient the next time you choke on a chicken bone.
What does it eat? Bates asked.
I couldn't say. I found gizzard-like contractiles around the cloacae, which implies they chew on something, or did at some point in their history. Other than that,
he spread his hands. The cigarette left faint streamers in its wake.
Inflate those contractiles enough and you create an airtight seal, by the way. In conjunction with the cuticle, that would allow this organism to survive briefly in vacuum. And we already know it can handle the ambient radiation, though don't ask me how. Whatever it uses for genes must be a great deal tougher than ours.
So it can survive in space, Bates mused.
In the sense that a dolphin survives underwater, limited time only.
How long?
I'm not certain. Central nervous system,
Sarasti said.
This ends Disc 6.